afternoon and welcome to another edition of Spotlight Africa. I am Assumpta Oturu. Spotlight Africa brings you news analysis and current affairs of the African continent, including global issues affecting Africa, African diaspora, and the global south. Today we focus on the situation in Ukraine from the perspective of African countries' voting patterns at the United Nations. At the 11th emergency session of the United Nations General Assembly held early this month, 27 African countries were among the 141 countries that voted in favor of the resolution that called on Russia to immediately end its military operations in Ukraine. 17 African countries were among the 35 who abstained, while Eritrea was the only African country that joined Russia, Syria, North Korea, and Belarus in opposing the United Nations resolution, which was sponsored by 90 countries and required a two-thirds majority to pass at the United Nations General Assembly.
So you do have those countries that anyway, we don't get anything from them. And they take decisions sometimes, not often, sometimes decisions that are rebellious in nature, but are not addressing their strategic interests. You see that kind of a behavior and so on. So I think Eritrea had nothing to lose because it's subjected to a host of sanctions and there's no investment that moves into that country.
The majority of African countries which abstained had historical links to Russia from the days of the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union then supported colonial liberation struggles in Africa. But why, despite the support, those countries abstained, including China? Why did the majority of the world vote against the Russian Federation? How come Russia only got support from four countries out of the 193 member nations of the United Nations? The answer to those questions could probably be found in individual countries' complex relations with the Western powers. The Russian invasion of Ukraine also revealed to the world the racism against people of African descent, mostly students, in the Eastern European nation. I am Assumpta Oturu. Stay tuned to Spotlight Africa here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and streaming live on kpfk.org.
The African countries, in most instances, even on issues that are related to the continent, have always voted in terms of the donor countries. I remember during the apartheid years when different resolutions were presented at the UN, though within the OAU at that stage, African countries would be united. But when it comes to resolutions at the AU, and they would tell you some of those countries to say, we've been approached that if we vote in this manner, our aid is going to be terminated. So there has been a checkbook diplomacy with the donor countries for quite a long time. And until African countries are basically independent to make sovereign decision on critical issues around the world, would continue to see this pattern of behavior that emerges within the continent. So that's essentially the thrust of the pattern of African countries' vote that you see within international organizations. It's informed by donor countries. And some of these countries are entirely dependent on donor countries for their own budget, for their daily survival.
It is the checkbook diplomacy, according to Dr. Kingsley Makubela, which makes African countries at the United Nations or any other international forums to vote against their own interests. The African country's adherence to donor dictates is rooted in colonial economic and political structures imposed on Africa during the colonial period. But in the recent 11th United Nations emergency sessions, Eritrea broke ranks and joined Russia in opposing the United Nations resolution that called on Russia to immediately end its military operations in Ukraine. For more on the Eritrean vote, we turn to Dr. Kingsley Makubela. Dr. Kingsley Makubela is currently the executive director of the South African-based Risk Recon. He was formerly a diplomat, serving his country, South Africa, in various ambassadorial capacities in Kenya, Portugal, and a variety of international forums, including the United Nations Environmental Programme, UNEP. Again, here is Dr. Kingsley Makubela.
Well, it is quite astonishing to see Eritrea voting against the resolution, as opposed to a lot of countries, including in my own country, South Africa, that abstained. You remember, Eritrea has been, for quite a long time, projected as a pariah state. Eritrea has had a lot of challenges with Ethiopia when the West was very much supportive of Ethiopia, I think, until the recent conflict. Eritrea has been projected as a pariah when it comes to the conflict in Somalia and so on. So essentially, they have nothing to lose. So you do have those countries that anyway, we don't get anything from them. And they take decisions sometimes, not often, sometimes decisions that are rebellious in nature, but are not addressing their strategic interests. You see that kind of a behavior and so on. So I think Eritrea had nothing to lose because it's subjected to a host of sanctions and there's no investment that moves into that country to a large extent. So those are the challenges.
How do you see African countries moving out of this, if one can refer to behavioral vote that is influenced by external factors rather than by internal interest?
Well, the African continent is very much endowed with resources. And these resources are essentially extracted from the continent and sold out. And until there's some value add in terms of the resources that we are having in the continent, we're still going to see this pattern of donor dependency. Until we have some good systems of governance in the continent and issues of corruption, not looting state resources and keeping them essentially in the very same developed countries, the level of independence from our leaders is going to be murky. So we need to be self-sufficient in order to make decisions that are in the best interest of us as African or us as individual African countries, because Africa is quite huge and very diverse even in terms of interests. But this dependency on donor, this dependency on technology that comes from the Western countries to a large extent, you're starting to see that coming from China too. It's going to create a huge challenge for us moving forward. So we need to have some level of economic dependency. We can then start to reset our own political independence on crucial issues affecting the world, even participating in the design of the global architecture that really is so required at this time.
What I also found very interesting, Dr. Makubela, was the fact that I guess maybe it's rather question in the sense that if we look back, I think it was 2002, 2003, around there, before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, when they presented the issue to the United Nations, the question then for many countries was, are you going to join us or are you going to be on the side of evil? And the U.S. was able to muscle countries to support it. And the UN, which was set up to be a sort of a peace stabilizer at a global level, became a weapon for the invasion of Iraq. So my question is, how come Russia does not have the same strength to mobilize nations to its side the way the U.S. is able to?
Well, you see, when President Bush at that stage came up with the statement, you are with us or with them, he made it quite clear that there's no neutrality. And remember the footprint, the U.S., when the U.S. was saying this, they were carrying a lot of their Western partners with them. And in that bag of Western partners, you have former colonial masters. And most of the African states have been created as a front line for colonial powers. And the weaknesses of the African state, and literature shows this, it's because these weaknesses are premised on the colonial state. Now, those challenges are still there. It was not only the U.S., the United Kingdom came in, France, everyone, the coalition that was set up by President Bush. And they were basically silencing any voices of dissent with respect to the war in Iraq. And they managed to do that using economic powers. I mean, the statement that you are with us or with them prevented a lot of financial support that comes from the U.S., a government to some of these developing countries within the continent or to the African continent. Now, those are challenges. When people start to say, when there's no bread on the table and say, if you don't join us, we're taking even the very little that you have on your table because it comes from us, it's a huge challenge. Those are the issues that keeps on making the challenges of an equitable international system that respects the diversity that it should have and still be able to coexist without any conflict. That's why the system is basically intolerant of any diverse views that you may see in the global arena, because you got to take side. You would recall the Russians don't have a good footprint within the continent for social development or developmental project as such, as compared to some of the colonial powers, including the U.S., which was not a colonial power in this case. So they have a footprint around those issues, and they keep on using them, and they understand how to use them.
And many people also attribute to the weakness of Russia soon after the fall of the Soviet Union as part of problem to rebuild itself. But then it's been trying to woo Africa to this its side. So the U.S. and the West have the economic power, and therefore that kind of weakens Russia's ability to be able to muscle countries within the UN General Assembly the same way the U.S. does. That's what you're saying, Dr. Makubela.
The biggest Russian export to the continent, unfortunately, is the Kalashnikov, that is involved in almost every conflict that you see in the continent. That's a footprint that you can see, used by civil militia groups, by criminals and so on. It has become a weapon of choice. And the availability of the weapon within the continent has been a huge challenge. But the economic footprint of the Russians and Russian engagement in the continent, it's not there. And that's why the leverage of economic power helps big powers to get their way, particularly dealing with countries that have created some level of dependency on them. I mean, you look at, as an example, the amount of oil that Nigeria produces, and you see the prices of gasoline in Nigeria, you still ask yourself why, when so much is produced, you expect this kind of... So there's no correlation between those issues. But the whole thing, if you look at deep into it, is the economic architecture of the colonial powers. I mean, the big battle now, it's projected within the African continent. It's going to be a battle around our resources. Resources like coltan that produces cell phone that it's found mostly in the DRC and I think Mali, they've discovered huge deposit around that. But the world would depend on this two countries in terms of culture to make cell phones and so on. So you're going to see this big battle for the African continent. And you ask yourself, the DRC with this kind of mineral resources, they don't have any peace. What is it? And if you get deep into it, a very independent and sovereign DRC is not to the best interest of countries that want to extract the mineral resources of the DRC, which are very strategic in nature.
Yeah, but one also would say that maybe the reason why Russia tends to export ammunition to Africa may be historical, because that's what it did in reference to the liberation struggles in Southern Africa and so forth. So it pursued its interest through support of the armed struggle against the West in parts of Southern Africa and other areas under the Portuguese colonies and so forth. So could this still be the trend? Because even if you look at the current Wagner, some people refer to them mercenaries, some people refer to them as the Russian, you know, military force and so forth. They seem to be also doing similar kind of fighting indirectly, because some people would argue, Dr. Mankubela, that those insurgents that or the jihads and so forth that are terrorizing the sections of West Africa came as a result of what happened in Libya, and therefore the fingers may be pointed at the West for having toppled and killed Gaddafi.
You're absolutely correct with respect to the proliferation of the small arms that the Russians provided during the armed liberation struggle here in Southern Africa, in East Africa, the conflict between Ethiopia and Somalia. You see a footprint of that. So it's quite true that those small arms were very much useful during the liberation struggle, and some of them that we see now, they come from that historic background. But I just don't think this is how the Russians should be known, as the exporter of arms only. Now, post the 1990s, when the Soviet Empire fell, there should have been a better projection of the Russians, what they can provide to the continent and the partnership they can provide within the continent. I think the Russians were too late in terms of dealing with those issues and understanding the geostrategic importance of the African continent and essentially collaboration with the African continent. With respect to the private military group, Wagner, I mean, it's a private military group. They thrive in situation of instability. And I think it was a monumental mistake, really, to topple Gaddafi, and everyone starting to acknowledge that. And ironically, my own country voted for the NATO operation against Gaddafi. And later on, it caused a serious debate within the South African political system to say, why did we do that? And that has created a vast area of instability that was not there. The Maghreb area has always had contestation, but the instability that we're seeing and the proliferation of weapons around the area, it can be attributed to a very large extent to that. And it's destabilizing all these governments and the armaments that Gaddafi had. Remember, Gaddafi had this grand idea that he would be the commander-in-chief of Africa, and he started to build his military along that and acquiring large amounts of weapons. And most of these weapons were not provided by the Western countries. So it's actually true. And there is history to reference. When Iraq was attacked, that part of the world was a bit stable, Syria and so on. But since the attack and the toppling of Saddam Hussein, it has created ISIS, Al-Qaeda came out of that. So we started to see new groups that were essentially emerged as a resistance to the occupation by the American. And you want to see the same thing in Libya. You're starting to see factions that are emerging there, some of them to protect General Khalif Haftar and the Russians, the Russian group of private military companies. Now, it's not only the Russians. Remember the Blackwater private security company in Iraq, which was essentially funded also by paid by the U.S. government. And literature shows that 29% of the U.S. intelligence community work comes from this private security company. So they are a fundamental instrument to the state. I have done a research around civil militia groups, and in my PhD thesis, I've defined what I call a third generation of civil militia groups. And that function in total collapse of the state, because they can't function if there's a contestation of power. You need to deal with all instruments of power, then this militia groups start emerging. And you will see in areas that there's a total collapse of state institution, this kind of groups are quite common. It's not only Wagner, it's all other militia groups that are starting to take sides according to their government inclinations.
More with Dr. Kingsley Makubela later. As we now take a music and station break, I am Assumpta Uturu. You are listening to Spotlight Africa here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, and streaming live online on kpfk.org. Coming up next, Dr. Kingsley Makubela speaks to the role of mercenaries, military groups, which mostly serve the interests of their countries in their militaristic adventures in the global south.
This is April Grace, and you and I are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also streaming online at kpfk.org.
Yeah, and as you're speaking, Dr. Makubela, I'm thinking of Bob Denard, who was the French mercenary who walked through Africa overthrowing governments, and Comoro was his playground for quite some time. So I guess when you look back and think about such an individual, and then now you have groups of individuals that are sort of pursuing the same goals in the interests of their countries, what is the difference then? You know,
the biggest issue for groups like Bob Denard, who later was known as Mad Bob, around particularly Southern Africa and so on. And even the apartheid government pumped a lot of money in him. It's the overt support and the COVID support that used to be provided, even by the French government, because it was a French national. Here in South Africa, we passed a legislation that prohibits this kind of groups, mercenary groups. But they call themselves different names that legally, once they start to rebrand themselves in a particular way, but the behavior is still a mercenary behavior. You would not be really legally to take action against this kind of group. But in developed countries, they are created deliberately to do the dirty work that government cannot do. I mean, if you look at the Blackwater behavior in Iraq, it's quite appalling. If that was committed directly by a state institution, it would be a huge challenge. And I think you would find the same behavior with the Wagner Group. You'd find their modus operandi has no regard to the protocol with respect to conduct of military combatants and so on. So they are able to do things that, in terms of conventions governing wars, they won't be able to pass the standard. So, but they provide good instrument because states are able to avoid being held to account by using this kind of groups.
Going back to Russia then, I know there was a summit in terms of trying to change that militaristic support or financing in Africa, although the U.S. is also guilty in terms of arms supplies. Russia, through the meeting, I think it was in 2019, sometime in October, seemed to sort of trying to be welcomed into Africa through other technological sharing, and of course through the, which people don't talk much about now, the BRICS countries, which is fallen off the international arena discussion. And there's supposed to be another Russia-Africa summit later this year, but I'm just wondering whether this would be possible given what is happening in Ukraine, Dr. Mabella.
You're going to see if the Russians were to convene this meeting, and the Russians are likely to try to convene it to try to show that there are countries that are in solidarity with Russia. It's crucial for them to project that within their country. But you're going to see a lot of resistance from the U.S. and the West about this engagement. And it's likely not to take place because of the opposition to that. And again, the checkbook diplomacy would come into play where these countries will be seriously threatened that if you were to carry on and do this, we're going to stop all this support, even sanctions. Because remember, the sanctions that are imposed against Russia now are not mandatory sanctions. These are unilateral sanctions by a group of countries. Mandatory sanction can only be issued out by the Security Council. And in view of the paralysis within the Security Council, countries have opted to do that. But they've really tried to use their power. Remember the senator from New York, may his soul rest in peace, Diamanto, who came up with the Diamanto Act with respect to sanctions the U.S. has unilaterally imposed on Iran. And that makes it a criminal offense for anyone to do anything in terms of the U.S. law. So you've seen that extraterritoriality by the United States. It's quite common. You're going to see this kind of behavior, too, in terms of this. I know there have been talks between China and the U.S., and from what one is reading from the media, there's no progress with respect to those talks. And the talks are mainly to ensure that China imposes sanctions on Russia. And I can tell the Chinese will not do that because they have their own interests. A few, 2 years ago, there was a serious opposition to the Chinese Huawei communication company and their production of cell phones and their introduction of 5G in the market. They are the first to introduce it. The U.S. was up in arms to say this is going to be used to eavesdrop on Western government. The United Kingdom had actually to cancel that kind of arrangement. But it has nothing to do with that. Any cell phone, myself included, I use iPhone. They probably listen to me, whatever they want to listen. But who cares about people who eavesdrop on each other? Anything you can eavesdrop on it, given the modern technology now. This was to prevent the growth of the Chinese technology and the footprint of Chinese technology around the world. Here in South Africa, we do have 5G provided by Huawei. They sell their cell phones here. But they are prohibited to sell their cell phone in other Western countries because of this competition not to see technological advancement of China. So the relationship, and this is unfortunate, my sister, that this sanctions against Russia are going to rewrite the global architecture in respect of finance. For instance, Russians, no MasterCard, no Visa, they are using their Mir. But SWIFT is blocked. The Chinese have an alternative, and the Russians are going to plug into it. The Indians are quite interested to plug into it, too. India has stopped using a Visa for quite some time. So the financial system is going to be redrawn. Iran may join that group. So you're going to have close to 3 billion people, population of the world, subscribing to a particular financial system. It's going to be a big loss to MasterCard, to Visa in terms of business. I think they regret this kind of sanction wherever they are sitting. Because once you've created that platform, it will be an alternative to what has been provided by Visa and MasterCard for many years. And SWIFT will become irrelevant because the biggest population in the world will subscribe to a total different model of transferring funds across borders.
Meanwhile, some Western think tanks are speculating about the prospective economic benefits to African countries with natural gas deposits. According to Eurostat, or the European Statistical System, in 2017, 30% of European petroleum oil imports and 39% of the total gas imports came from Russia. For Estonia, Poland, Slovakia, and Finland, more than 75% of their petroleum imports come from Russia. But are the current Western sanctions against Russia realistic, given European dependency on Russian natural gas? Even if there are alternatives, meaning the United States, African countries, namely Senegal, Nigeria, Algeria, Tanzania, and Mozambique, how soon could these new sources of natural gas replace Russian supply? Again, here is Dr. Kingsley Makubela, who is currently the executive director of the South African-based Risk Recon.
The biggest gas deposit has been discovered recently in Mozambique, about 100 billion cubic liters of cubic of gas. And Tanzania has about 70 billion, and they share this gas deposit because they're on the border of the two countries. It's the biggest in the African continent. There are small ones discovered in Namibia and so on. It's going to be too expensive. It is transportable. There are ships that are transporting this kind of liquid gas, but it's going to be too expensive. It's going to hit the pockets of consumers very heavily in the United States and won't be sustainable politically in the long run for both the Democrats and the Republicans. They would want to find a situation that would provide better guarantees to consumers. And particularly in countries like the US, where consumers have a big power in terms of their own votes, that they can decide to change the direction and force a particular consumption pattern. So you're going to see those kind of instability created. In Europe, it's not sustainable. Russia provides, as I've seen in the news, 40% of gas to Europe. And Europe would not survive in the cold without the Russian one. And in Germany, there's already a serious revolt amongst people who are starting to ask themselves crucial questions around this stop in the phase two of the transportation of liquid gas into Germany that's so much dependent on the Russian. So there's going to be national interests that will come into play, but this national interest will be compounded by the rise of prices in countries and the resentment around that, because it's going to affect, these sanctions are going to affect the global economy so much that all of us are going to feel it around the world. I mean, in South Africa, the price of gasoline went up last month, and it's projected now we pay more than 20 rands per liter. And it's expected to go up by another 1.50 rand, close to a dollar, which is so expensive here in a country where you have a large number of population who live on $1. They're on the poverty line, that they survive on $1, you know, per day. So you can understand what these challenges will raise in terms of the prices of commodities around the world, the transportation and everything. It's going to be a huge problem. And I don't think all of us are going to be saved from this. And it's not sustainable in the long run. I think there will be a solution in the long run. And in my own view, the solution should include going back to the drawing board. when the Soviet Union crumbled and have a better relationship between Russia and the West. And I think Germany, it's now going to spend about 100 billion euros to revamp their military. Because I think the Germans are starting to realize that NATO cannot be an instrument of the future because it was created on the basis of the Cold War. It can be. There's a need for a new security architecture around Europe. And that security architecture must include the Russians. And I think the Germans are starting to really realize that you never have peace and stability in the European continent as long as you don't integrate the Russians. And part of the mistakes that were made was to kick out the Russians out of the G8. I mean, what is the problem if you don't agree with people? Do they agree amongst themselves? I mean, there's been a trade war looming during the Donald Trump administration between Europe and the U.S., but it's never reached a stage where they really kick each other out. And how do you define the global architecture without including all role players in that system? So there's a need to rethink about some of those issues. But I think Germany is starting to ask questions. I've seen an article that is circulating on the media that purports to be a Macron's discussion to his diplomats around the global architecture and mistakes that have been made in terms of managing the relationship between Russia and Europe. And there's a thinking that Europe needs to stand up and NATO, really, people are starting to question the relevance of NATO.
Our conversation with Dr. Kingsley Makubela continues shortly as we now take a music and station break. I am Assumpta Oturu. You are listening to Spotlight Africa here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, and streaming live on kpfk.org. Coming up next, Dr. Kingsley Makubela discusses the racial discrimination against people of African descent, mostly students, when they sought to cross the Polish border.
Southern California, this is Ziggy Marley and your free speech radio station KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles and 98.7 in Santa Barbara. Support.
Imagine no possessions.
From late February, when the Russian military venture began in Ukraine, the world has witnessed news reports about people of African descent, mostly students, including other non-European nationalities, being denied entry into some Eastern European countries bordering Ukraine. Here is Abanulo from Nigeria speaking on MSNBC.
We still have people trapped, like in Sumy, in Ukraine. There are students, thousands of them, trapped because the bridges have been destroyed by bombs and everything, so they can't move. They are trapped there. No more food, no more water. So how are they going to feed? How are they going to survive?
Channel 4 News also featured Nigerian diplomats arranging transportation for Nigerian students out of Ukraine. It is reported that there are about 6,000 Nigerian students in Ukraine. Here is Parik O'Brien of Channel 4 News speaking to some Moroccan medical students who were being transported out of Ukraine.
This carriage is full of young Moroccans, all from the same faculty of medicine at Kharkiv University. Full of dreams dashed.
The door shattered of dreams. We don't know what's going to happen to us. We can't know what are we going to be a future doctors or not.
Did you always want to be a doctor?
Yes, since I was a child.
And our parents, they were very, very scared. It was like terrible.
According to the BBC estimate, there are about 76,000 foreign students in Ukraine, mostly from Africa and Asia. The African students' presence in Eastern Europe dates back to the days of the Soviet Union. From the 1950s, African students received scholarships to attend college and professional schools in the Soviet Union. The People's Friendship University was established in the 1960s when most African countries gained independence from former European colonial powers. When Patrice Lumumba was assassinated in 1961, the People's University was renamed the Patrice Lumumba Friendship University. Now for a broader perspective on Africa-Russian relations, we again turn to Dr. Kingsley Mankubela, who is currently the executive director of the South African-based Risk Recon. Dr. Mankubela was formerly a diplomat, serving his country, South Africa, in various ambassadorial capacities in Kenya, Portugal, and a variety of international forums, including the United Nations Environmental Programme, UNEP.
The Patrice Lumumba University was based in Moscow, and that was the arrangement of during the Soviet Union. The mayor had satellite institutions around the USSR at that stage, but the main campus was in Moscow. I visited it during those days. I never studied there. I just wanted to be quite clear. But the things that we're seeing of racism in Ukraine has been a source of concern, not only now during the war, the attacks against a lot of Africans who go there, even footballers who used to go and play football, professional footballers, they were haunted by racism amongst the Ukrainians. And there's an assumption that in the last few years, the neo-Nazi groups have been really developing within the Ukraine. Not only in the Ukraine, even in Russia itself, we've seen this kind of group starting to emerge that is so anti-blacks and they have the hallmarks of Nazi groups and so on. But they were aided and abated by the trend that was starting to emerge around the world, where the world was shifting to the far right in terms of a lot of government. I mean, even the center right in countries like the Scandinavian at one stage were shaken. So you started to see those kind of behaviors and those tendencies. You recall the killing of large number of people in Denmark by somebody who really killed these people because they were foreigners, and turned out the majority of them were Danish and so on. So you started to see that behavior around the world. It was not a mistake. It was aided by this change in terms of political trend that was emerging around the world. The far right was gaining momentum in the U.S. and so on. I mean, even President Trump was starting to call them and want to bring them in his administration because they provide some votes and so on. The African race has always suffered this kind of discrimination. It doesn't matter how you excel. Discrimination, it's still a part of that. Even here in our own country, where we've fought so many years of racial discrimination, you still find serious discrimination patterns, and some of them are interwoven into the daily life of a lot of people. And I think it's going to take time. In the U.S., I mean, if you look at the abolishment of so many legislation relating to discrimination, but the behavior on the ground is still a huge change. It's only now in the U.S. they're starting to remove some symbols related to discrimination. But there's a serious resistance about them because they're seen in some communities as heroes. And Trump said it quite openly.
But then why don't African governments stand up for their citizens?
The question is, how would they stand up? What can they do? They have no power to do anything, not even look at the voting pattern. If you were to put African countries in the same room and want them to come up with a common approach of dealing with our own student or our own people who have been stranded in that war, I can tell you never get a single outcome out of that meeting.
It's just terrible that you are reminded every time who you are, and you wonder why the world continues to do so. Yes,
you look at the American group that called itself Blackwater, a private security company. It's a militia group that has been so brutal in Iraq. Why Blackwater? Have you ever seen Blackwater? Somebody who conceptualized this thing. And I like what Jesse Jackson used to say, that everything that has to do with black must be wrong. Black male, black list, and so on. So you can see the notion that is embedded in terms of our own race as black people, that wherever we go, we have serious challenges to be accepted. And the war now in Ukraine has brought this to the fore. The way the world is so concerned about people who are dying there. But when people were bombed in Libya and all those things going on there, bombed by NATO, no one was saying anything. And that's when the U.S. came out to say these are collateral damages in a war. It's accepted because the black soul is the one which has been decimated. And it's really unfortunate that we have to stand up as a continent and really define our future. And that lies in our economic independence and trading with each other.
I also saw some reports about, I think it's Ukraine that is taking Russia because of this invasion to the International Criminal Court, or is it the International Court of Jury, maybe to both. How will they succeed? Because Nicaragua did the same to the U.S. about the mining of its cost, but even though it was ruled against the U.S., the U.S. didn't do anything, you know.
It's, again, power politics. Would anyone sanction the Russians? I hear some people starting to speak about the investigation of war crimes. It would end up there. It would have no other effect. But it was the ones that went to take out Laurent Gbagbo and take him to The Hague for war crimes, and eventually he was found not guilty. If it was here in the continent, they would be up in arms to want to bring them to justice. Even up to today, the war in Iraq casualties, George Bush hasn't been taken to any court to account for that. And it would not happen even in terms of the Russians. So big powers, they have the right to operate with any form of impunity, unchecked impunity for that matter.
And in concluding then, how do you see this war coming to an end? How do you see a permanent, if one can talk about it, coexistence within Europe in terms of Ukraine? Because Ukraine has a lot of strong ties to Russia, given that even two of the leaders of the Soviet Union and who led the Soviet Union for almost 29 years were from Ukraine. So there seems to be a strong rootedness of that connection that it is cannot be sort of cut off because of the U.S. desire for it to join NATO.
The unfortunate thing is that countries like Russia, they were not part of the drawing of the African borders. So the European-African borders essentially were reinforced during the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia. And since that Treaty of Westphalia, a lot of changes have been made, for instance, to Ukraine, coming back to specific case. Even some of them made by Khrushchev. Khrushchev was Ukrainian and was a Soviet leader, gave some of the territories that are historically Russian territory to the Ukraine. It's a huge portion. And when he did that, there were no problem because that was still the Soviet. And this is what is coming back to haunt the borders of the Soviet. The same approach, I think, should be sought with respect to how the former Yugoslavia's borders were drawn and how the former Yugoslavia disintegrated. There's a precedent in terms of how those states emerge. I think eventually I can project that that will be a permanent solution for a peace, but it must be integrated within the broader global security architecture of the new Europe and outside NATO to provide security assurance even to smaller states. I can imagine smaller states now are terrified of what may happen to them. Can we risk the Cold War if Russia was to attack any part of Latvia, which is part of NATO? Would they really go to war with Russia and trigger a third world war and a potential nuclear war? I think those are issues that people need to think about when they think about the new architecture of security of Europe and really to reduce the tensions that exist because of the security buildup along this.
That brings us to the end of our conversation with Dr. Kingsley Makubela. Dr. Makubela is currently the executive director of the South African Best Risk Recon. Dr. Makubela was formerly a diplomat, serving his country South Africa at various ambassadorial capacities in Kenya, Portugal, and a variety of international forums, including the United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP. In our special feature today, our focus was on the current war in Ukraine from the perspective of Africa-Russian relations, which date back to the days of the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union supported African liberation movements in the struggle against European colonial dominance. I am Assumpta Oturu. We've now come to the concluding moments of our program. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, Spotlight Africa broadcasts are now archived on the KPFK website and that's kpfk.org. For any comments, please feel free to email us at spotlightafrica@kpfk.org. So until next time, peace and love, stay strong, stay tuned to KPFK. Coming up next is the Car Show, and coming up at 4 p.m., African music from Africa and the African world on Aphrodisia with Namdi.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind & Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
KPFK invites you to tune into The Global Village, weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., bringing you a global mix of hosts, seeking the universal soul and making musical connections between our geographical and musical cultures. That's The Global Village, KPFK's flagship music program with new and familiar voices, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right here on 90.7 FM and online at kpfk.org.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 Santa Barbara.
Hi, I'm Sergio Mionyshenko with the Global Village. Join me Fridays at 11 a.m. with music from around the world and around the block, as well as some very special interviews. Fridays from 11 to 1 p.m. right here on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, also streaming on kpfk.org.
Support KPFK by donating your used car, truck, or other vehicle to us. It's simple and easy. Call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. You get a tax write-off and an opportunity to support Los Angeles's only truly independent radio station, KPFK. Call us now at 877-KPFK-AUTO.
$10 might seem like a small amount, but when you sign up as a KPFK Sustainer Circle member, that $10 helps pay for daily broadcast of Democracy Now!, the Tom Hartman Program, and all of the news and information you hear on KPFK. You get a lot for your monthly contribution, and we need that gift right now to keep bringing you all of the programs you count on. $10 makes a big impact. We combine it with contributions from your fellow listeners who rely on KPFK as much as you do. Public radio only works with you. This is Kathy Diaz, the Monday host of the Global Village, encouraging you to contribute now. Go to kpfk.org, then click Sustainer Circle. Whatever you can do, please do. Thank you.
Get your rockin' shoes, we're gonna rock and roll. Come on, cats, let's go, go, go.
Hi, I'm Bill Gardner, host of Rhapsody in Black. I play classic rhythm and blues from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Boogie with Bill Gardner every Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4 on KPFK 90.7 FM.
Rock that boogie!
Hi, everyone. I know you've heard our fundraisers and likely thought, yeah, I should likely give something back to KPFK. Well, now's the time to do it. We all understand the value of separating luxuries from necessities and deciding what's truly essential. KPFK is one of those essentials. We provide in-depth, cutting-edge, intelligent coverage, and it starts with our amazing staff and volunteer programmers and with your financial support. Contributions from our listeners add up to the largest share of funding that pays the bills here at KPFK. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, encouraging you to become a KPFK Sustainers Circle member now. A sustaining contribution of just $20 or more a month is one of the most popular levels for our donors, and it takes just minutes to contribute. Just go to kpfk.org/support, then click Sustainer Circle, or call 818-985-2711. Thank you so much for your donation to KPFK, radio powered by the people.
DJ Namde from Radio Aphrodisia. Join us every Saturday as we nice up your weekend. It's all about music from Africa and the African world. Radio Aphrodisia, 4 to 6 p.m. It's Champeta Criolla from the coast of Caribbean, Soca Calypso, Juju Music, Musica Afro Cubana, Cha Cha Cha, Afrobeat Highlife. It's all in the mix. Radio Aphrodisia, Saturdays, 4 to 6 p.m. showtime. Tune in!
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. The time now is 1 p.m.
A very good Saturday afternoon to you. This is The Car Show. I'm Dave Koontz.
And I'm Mark Vaughn with AutoWeek.com.